You're listening to the Communication Studies Podcast. My name is Justin Young. I'm a faculty member at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. And this week's guest is Zoe Friedgen. She is a master's student in the Performance Studies program. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Justin.
So Zoe just recently had a performance here in the department, a show called Left on Red. And so we're going to be talking about that show and getting to know Zoe a little bit better and everything as part of this. So before we get into the show and everything, Zoe, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how did you end up in performance studies? Like, you know, from being a little kid to now, like, that's a lot to cover.
Totally, yeah.
But like, maybe like what influenced you to go into this field of study?
So to start, as a kid born and raised in California and being surrounded by lots of friends and family who are in like performance industry and who do work for certain performance companies, I've always been surrounded by this notion to ham it up and to kind of be big. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, like at school, there would always be like, you know, cute school recitals. And I would always find just fun, unique, like moments while being on stage and performing in front of people. And while I was a kid going into like middle school, going into high school, I tampered that down quite a bit because, just like family stuff, but also too, one of my parents were very big into this notion of performance does not make you money. Anything dealing with performance or the arts, anything that you cannot make a stable living off of you will not succeed. Mm-hmm. And I had that in my head and engraved in my head for a very, very, very long time. And it wasn't until my second semester of freshman year in undergrad when I went to the University of Houston Clear Lake, I was in a basic public speaking class with Dr. Andrea Baldwin, and I remember giving a brown bag speech, and all of a sudden I saw her at the end of class kind of call me over and go, "Do you want to be in a show?" And from there, it just kind of kick-started off. I was a little nervous going into it because I had no acting experience. The only acting experience I did have was just me and my personality. And it was really nervous and nerve-wracking going into the audition because it was a cold read. My hands were shaking, like literally, like they couldn't stop shaking. I felt like I totally messed up the audition because I could not memorize to save my life. However, I learned that it wasn't about memorizing. It was just how well can I read a piece of material on the spot and how much can I experiment with that piece of material on the spot. And from there, I got the part. The first show that I was in was called Remember All, which is about the Harry Potter objects and how they relate to real life kind of anxieties and feelings that every human kind of goes through. So for example, the Dementors, whenever they have like the skull and the snake tattoo, that was a metaphor for anxiety and hurt kind of in life situations. So I got to play the only Gryffindor, which was really cool. But I got to kind of play my own house and it was unique.
So have you taken the survey online?
I have, yes.
So what house do you belong to?
I belong to the Gryffindors, and I know that's overplayed because everybody loves the Gryffindors. Harry's a Gryffindor, and da-da-da. No, I'm a Gryffindor ride till I die. I love it. they represent bravery and courage and just kind of fire in your belly, and that's definitely how I feel about myself, especially when I perform and when I do performance stuff. So, yeah.
So you may not remember this, but the brown bag speech that the teacher felt compelled to come over and mm-hmm. encourage you, do you remember what the topic of that speech was?
My speech was about my mom gave me when I was 18, because in the Jewish culture, 18 is a very lucky number. It represents in the Hebrew alphabet, hey, which is part of the hey and the yod are kind of together, and they make the word life, basically. So 18 birthdays are very special. So I remember talking about that. And I think I also was talking about, I was talking about my bat mitzvah dress. Which was I had my bat mitzvah like in 2012. So it was when Betsy Johnson was still like big. It was a black pleather Betsy Johnson bubble dress with pockets. And it was all geometric on the top. It looked like something early Lady Gaga would wear on the red carpet. And I was living. I felt so fabulous. But I was talking about those. And Andrea saw the passion and how much, you know, love I had for these objects and how much detail and in depth I went into it, and went way past the expectation of brown bag speeches and how they're supposed to be. And I think that was kind of where she was like, do you want to do a show? I see you have that that spark. So let's see if we can get it out of you more.
So you start into acting with this show, and then I assume other shows followed from that.
Yeah.
But how does that transition to you deciding, I want to continue to pursue my education, I'm going to do this in performance studies?
That's actually kind of a good question. Half of it, and I still kind of talk, like, debate back and forth about this, half of it is just so I can prove my family wrong and go, see, I can make art and do things that I love to do and make money for it, you know, and not be stuck in a 9-to-5, you know, office job, which, I mean, good on you, you know, that's still very hard and strenuous work, but that's not the work that I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I also know, it's solidified, that performance is a very beautiful method of exploring and dissecting kind of people, the world, events. And I just kind of was intrigued by that. As an undergrad, I got my bachelor's in psychology, specifically social psychology. So having that background of what things make people tick. And then from going to the Pettigene Festival and Patti Pace, combined just kind of pushed me to go in the direction of, I really want to pursue this in an academic setting. I want to know more about how to dematrix certain situations and how that could be played out on a stage versus how that could be played out in a museum or in the quad area. So I hope that answers the question. Yeah.
No, I think it does. So how do you end up at SIU?
Kind of a legacy thing. So Andrea Baldwin went to SIU, and then while she was teaching at UHCL, one of my very, very, very best friends, Christos, he went here to SIU for his master's, and he did a performance too called Nourish, which is a fabulous performance piece about like food and food culture and things like that. But after seeing his, I remember coming up, driving up to SIU with a couple of former friends and watching his show, getting to see Carbondale and just seeing kind of the people in the audience and talking with them, like at Key West, because I couldn't go to Cellar at the time. So it was just all of those experiences really drove hard the fact that, like, I really want to go to SIU. Also, a huge reason why I wanted to go to SIU is because of the legacy of performance that has been brought here. Lots of kind of front guard performances that aren't afraid to experiment with the body and aren't afraid to experiment with very touchy subjects that maybe some people are uncomfortable to talk about, like abortion or like catfishing or anything that makes them go, ugh. Mm-hmm. And that's what I enjoy SIU's performance program, because it's like, here, experiment with this. Why does it make you feel uncomfortable in a very lovely and supportive setting?
I have to ask, you mentioned seeing Carbondale and mm-hmm. like being so partly on Carbondale. Was it something specific? Was it the general vibe? What maybe sold you on Carbondale?
It was really the general vibe of it. The general vibe, and also talking to some of the graduate students. Like I remember talking to like Caleb and Alex Lockwood and Shelby and Scott and Devin as well, just kind of chit-chatting with them. Talking with Christos a lot about like, what's your experience with Carbondale? And he gave me a very honest analysis, which now I'm starting to see, as this is my second year being here. One of the things he warned about was definitely the snow, if Carbondale does get snow, but also too, definitely the seasonal depression and the size of Carbondale can be sometimes a little wary. However, just being able to talk with him really, really sold me on the fact that like Carbondale is an artist community, and it is definitely a place where I can thrive. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about your show.
Yes, let's get into it.
Your show is called Left on Red, and maybe can you give us the quick pitch for it, like the elevator pitch for what this show is about, and then we'll get into more of it later.
Totally. So Left on Red is a conversation piece about how does computer-mediated communication, which entails like chat rooms, and profile, like the ability to create profiles, to create online personalities, how those elements in a dating fashion influence us, influence users to perform or condition us to perform in front of people we don't know in real life, if that kind of makes sense. Basically, the short is looking at how computer-mediated communication has affected our interpersonal communication outside of an online space.
Okay. And we should note real quick that that Jesse Snyder co-directed this with you, and Alicia Utek served as assistant director for the production. So that's kind of the general pitch. How does this get started? So like, how do you pitch, I want to do a performance for the Kleinau Theater, and where is the, you know, maybe the genesis of the idea for this show?
So kind of answering the first question, the pitch, like, how did I do it? I remember the first semester when I came here for my master's program, sitting in Rebecca's office and going, I want to do a show. And Rebecca going, well, maybe you should take some classes and kind of see what you want to do and how the classes affect this idea that you want to do for a show, and then come back to me about doing a show. Mm-hmm. I did exactly that. And immediately in my second semester, I was like, I want to do a show. So Rebecca knew I was very hard set on doing a piece. And from there, I remember her giving me the necessary information, her saying like, all right, well, in April, that's when the Kleinau kind of does the general call for shows, and the process of doing it, which I have never done this process before. When I was at UHC, when I did my first, oh, I guess I should say, this is my first solo show. Mm-hmm. This is actually my second one. The first solo show I did was during COVID, called Obscene Phenomena, which was kind of sponsored by UHCL, but in a very weird way because COVID and things like that. But when I was kind of pitching the show, I just kind of was like, I really want to do the show. Here's all the citations and the theory of what's going to be put in my show. And here's a general kind of basis of how I want the show to go. That was when I pitched it to UHCL. When I pitched it at SIU, I was not prepared for the amount of detail and analysis of what to kind of give Johnny and Jesse, or I guess Devin at the time, in regards to my show. Like, I did not know I needed a vision board. I didn't know that I needed basically like to have everything pretty much planned out, kind of scene by scene.
Can you explain to our audience who may not know what's a vision board?
Yeah, so a vision board is similar to Pinterest boards. It's basically either physical or it's digital, but it has all different kinds of images that inspire art and artists to create a piece. So for my vision board, I had a lot of AI generated images of love, first kisses, dates. I think I had one that was, I typed in like putting on a mask for a date, and I got this weird, like, kind of gremlin-esque figure trying to like call someone on a phone. But it was a mix of that with AI, because in my show, I do mess around with AI as an art form, and also too as a method to creating like art. But also I think I had like a meme on there that was like, congratulations, you found your soulmate while sitting on the toilet. That was kooky, but it was also just a bunch of like quotes from Carl Jung and Peter Lambron Wilson and Ron Pelias.
Okay, so you do a vision board. Mm-hmm. What's the rest of that pitch process like?
So the vision board is sort of in like the later stages, but first, after you fill out this form, basically, that asks you to, you know, asks what the title is, who's going to be directing, co-directing, how long it's roughly going to be, scenes, how many they're going to be, what's going to happen or occur in these scenes, how far along in the script I've gotten at the time when I was writing my, the kind of form for the client out. I was a little more than halfway done with writing the script. And with all of that, I had to put it in a sort of packet and then email all of that information to Rebecca for her to look over it and then email it to Johnny afterwards. Then in a couple of weeks, Johnny sends out kind of this big email of, all right, here's what's going to sort of kind of be happening during the client out season. And then also around that time when he sends that email, performers, directors, et cetera, look at when the show is going to be, when the show was chosen for you and if that works or not. And then finally, after that's been settled and you know the date and you've already given the basic information to Johnny, then there is a, usually kind of at the beginning of the fall semester, kind of towards the end of August, there is a meeting for the managers for the directors and performers. That's like a community meeting. So anybody who's there, you as a director, ask the community how they can help you make your show a big success. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of that was the process, which really threw me for a loop. And it also gave me some really good experience, because I do plan on submitting more work to performance festivals. Mm-hmm. So getting this kind of in my body, I feel, is a very necessary and good tool to have in case I have to do that later on.
Right. So that's how you go through the process of pitching a show. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with the topic for this show? What made you want to do a show on, you know, how computer-mediated communication affects our love lives?
The show comes from a lot, or it was inspired a lot by my experiences dating in two very big cities and the interactions that would occur online in those spaces. I do want to acknowledge that. I know that, you know, my kind of experience is not the all end all. I know that everybody has their own experiences, their own ways of working with like dating apps. But solely for this show, I was just really irritated at the fact that like I felt like I had to be something that I'm not. For example, there were many dates living kind of in Texas where like I'd be broke, but like I felt like I had to spend a lot of money just to keep up. Or if any person takes me out on a date, I felt this pressure to automatically have sex with them afterwards because they treated me to dinner, dessert, whatever. I felt that pressure a lot while dating. And again, this is just my experience and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But the show overall, the inspiration for this kind of came from when I actually met my partner, Walter. And that afterwards, I just fell head over heels for him. But he was also one of the first kind of individuals I've interacted on a dating app who seemed the most quote unquote genuine. And by genuine, I mean how he was online was exactly how he was in person, mm-hmm. which was very weird to me because before him, I was used to, you know, like a dude with like, if I could paint the picture, there was like one guy that was like, he had a picture of him in his like sports car with the like the top down holding like stacks of cash, and the next one is him in Galveston with a surfboard and his like abs are showing, and he seemed like, you know, a very philanthropy kind of guy, but then when I met him he was just an average Joe working at Chick-fil-A, so it was like really weird. But Walter was the first person that I actually felt and saw, like, wow, this is exactly who you are, which got me thinking, well, why do I feel like, you know, I'm having to perform this way? Or maybe other people kind of feel that way as well.
So you said a couple of things I kind of wanted to ask you about. Mm-hmm. One, you said you had to spend a lot of money to sort of keep up. And I kind of wondered if you could expand on that, what you mean by that. Like, what are you spending money on to date?
At the time, a lot of it was, like, clothes, just to kind of keep up with fashion and trends. As most know, like, when living in, like, a pretty large city, that is very trendy forward. You know, appearance matters. So there was that. But also, too, like, for me, I date. My sexuality is open, so like I was also dating a lot of girls too, mm-hmm. and because it was a very strange kind of, well, strange at first, and then I got used to it. But the switch of like, okay, well now because I'm going on, I asked her out on a date. I feel the need to pay for these things for her, you know, to make sure like she's not spending a lot of money because I really like her. Or I remember there was one date that I went on where I bought us like drive-through movie tickets. I bought us food, snacks, candy, whatever. And the money that I was spending, I thought was like going to be, you know, for something good. I wasn't expecting sex or any sexual favors. I just wanted, you know, the person to feel comfortable and be like, hey, I can maybe rely on her. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. A lot of those kind of went downhill because it went from like cute dates like that to like, hey, can you sell me a couple bucks? Or like, hey, can you PayPal me like some money? I got to do this and that. And I'm like, I'm not a sugar mama. So like, I barely have enough money for, you know, my own things. So I guess that's what I mean by like shelling out money.
Right. The other thing that you noted was that you felt there was pressure to have sex when dating. Where do you think that comes from?
I mean, I can only really speak from my own personal experience, but sure. I could see this coming from a lot of different angles. Two that come to mind are the unspoken assumptions of dating rules. So like, you know how, I mean, like, you know, like the typical, like, the man pays for the woman in this context, male masculine in person pays for the feminine person, feminine individuals like food, opens doors, chivalry to pose nice. But then like, it's kind of weird to like, I guess, talk about this because I'm trying to find the words for it, but it's like this, there's so much consideration and niceness coming from this person. Mm-hmm. It sort of feels in a very like in a situational sense that like, okay, you're doing all these nice things for me, now how can I repay you back? And you know, If you're broke like me, you don't got a lot of money. There are other ways. So that is kind of where some of that comes from. But also, too, again, like, just with dating experiences. Like, I've had people right after a date be like, all right, so you want to fuck? And I'm like, no, I just want to get food with you. Like, it's like, can we not just, like, sit down and have, like, a drink and talk? We don't have to, like, have sex immediately after. Like, mm-hmm. So those were kind of two I guess, examples as to kind of this pressure? Yeah, I hope that answers the question.
No, it does. And I mean, I think the sort of point you're making is that dating can at times feel very transactional.
Very, yeah.
Like, and whether it was with a man or with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe could you talk a little bit, because obviously your show, as you noted, is influenced by your dating experience. And you did mention the apps, and that's a fairly large part of the show as well, is this, you know, the interaction via different apps and everything. What was that experience like? Because I feel like there are people who are listening who may have never dated via an app before. They may have no experience with Tinder or Bumble or any of these sorts of apps. So what is that experience like?
Dating online is a very exciting, weird, funny at times, and really, really irritating at other times experience. Everybody's experience is different because, I mean, not everybody is the same. So, I mean, like, every experience is different. But also, like, dating during COVID when everything was locked down really, really emphasized the need for someone to kind of be with you, or this kind of like, you know, oh, I'm feeling really lonely. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to the question at hand. When you date or use dating apps, they're 9 times out of 10, the general format is you log in, you sign up, and you create a profile. So you can, and with this, there are like so many intriguing ways you can go about it, because there is this factor of anonymity where nobody really knows who you are. Like, they can't just, you know, peer behind your screen and see who you are face to face. So it's really all about first impressions with dating apps. So typically you see photos of people that are a little more dressed up, that look a lot more presentable, kind of like marketing, like dating and marketing had a baby. That's kind of what it's kind of what like online dating apps are.
That does sound a nightmare.
It is, yeah, because, and it's hard, at least from like a female perspective, because there is, you know, if you want to find love and all you see are like thirst traps, and by thirst traps I mean individuals who pose or wear scants or pose very lewd, like, or wear like, you know, kind of scantily woven clothes and things like that. But there's also like a weird influence too. But with that, you also create the profile. You also have kind of a bio, which is another hard part of what the hell do I say to make a good first impression. The ones like I know I've seen when I lived in Texas was, I'm here for a long time. I'm here for a good time, not a long time, which automatically was like, all right, you're just here for a hookup. I mean, you're cool, you're pretty, but not my type. But creating that bio is really, really intense. There were many times where I'm just like, you know what? I don't want to have a bio, because like, I don't want somebody to just assume like, okay, well, if I put in my bio that I like horror movies and I'm a body painter, then that's all there really is to me. And I've kind of noticed when I did use dating apps is that, I mean, people will really find anything to start a conversation with you. And sometimes that can work in your favor and sometimes that doesn't. But after you've created this profile and you've put blood, sweat, and tears into creating the perfect you online, then you start the process of swiping. And what's cool about swiping is I read an article by founders Sean Rad and Justin Mateen that the Tinder algorithm is similar to a game where you're trying to find, you know, the game where it's like you're trying to find matching pairs of things. Mm-hmm. Similarly, Tinder's algorithm does that, where Tinder's algorithm is, the more you swipe, the more Tinder is trying to find out, okay, you like these things, you're not liking these things, let's switch the algorithm around so that you can start talking to people like that. And once you've found a match, you like somebody and the other person likes you, that's when the conversation starts, and that's kind of the third level into all of this, where you are in a sterile, and by sterile, I mean like emotionless kind of chat room where you both have to create emotions that can be quote unquote felt online. A lot of emojis are used, especially the more like raunchy ones, like the eggplant emoji or the peach emoji or the emoji with the tongue sticking out.
We'll let the audience figure out what those stand for.
Right. But yeah, like in chat rooms, you have to create your own energy. Like, it's not like how like you and I are like in a room, I can kind of feel the energy off of you, you can feel the energy off of me, and then we can go from there. Whereas in a chat room, you don't really get that. In the words of my show, you don't get proximity and physical closeness. You get delays in messages and the dreadful red, which for those that have not experienced the red, it's when somebody just notices that you've typed something, sees that you've typed it, and just doesn't respond, even though you can see that they have read it. So there's that troublesome item in dating apps.
Hence the title of your show,
Left
Exactly. For people wondering why we're talking about your dating life, that is the focus of the show. And it kind of leads us into, how does this show come together? How do you put together the show? You've pitched it. You have an idea for it. How do you then go about putting the show together?
Putting the show together is the part in the artistic plan that sometimes I even get really frustrated about, because I want to do so many things, but I also have to stick to the subject, similar to like how in a persuasive or an informative speech, you know, we tell our students, all right, stick to your thesis as much as possible, because it's so easy to get off track. It's similar in a performance space. It's so easy to want to do things that make people go, or, for the shock value of it. It's a little more difficult to get those moments, but also have them be in line with the subject. So one of the ways that I start the creative process of getting a show together is I find media influences that maybe I could use in the show. For example, in Left on Red, I used I use a lot of infomercials as an example. So at the beginning of, literally in the first scene of my show, I'm on stage trying on different outfits that correspond to different characters that I'm supposed to be portraying, or that one can purchase, to go on a date with. So I got a lot of that from, I remember as a kid watching like infomercials of like, you can purchase the Fushigi for like, you know, $16.99 plus shipping and handling, you know, and you're enticed by the colors and what people have said about this thing. So that's kind of where I got the beginning parts of my show. A bunch of other media inspiration for my piece. Oh, sorry.
And when we should probably explain to the audience, you're trying on different outfits.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, the cool laid back person, the sort of hippie outfit, and and that's changing your personality and kind of being sold to you in the show.
Yes. And that's what I'm trying to sell to my date, quote unquote, mm-hmm. my date, towards the end of the show. But some of the other media pieces that inspired me to kind of do certain things, you've seen Black Mirror. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you remember the episode Hang the DJ? I think it's in like the third or fourth season, but it's the episode where they're in a dating compound and dating apps have gone far beyond the cell phone.
Yes, yes.
So a lot of my inspiration for this piece came from that episode, especially, this continuous cyclical cycle of go on a date. Maybe it goes great. Maybe it doesn't. All right. Now you got to feel your feelings while you're going on the next date and repeat and repeat and repeat, which led into how at the end of my show, I don't really wrap things up in a nice, neat bow where everything's fine, dating apps are great, or dating apps suck. It's how have I taken the aspects of dating apps and the challenges, the unspoken rules of dating apps, and how can I go forward with this information? So that came from Black Mirror. But once I get all the media inspiration, then that's when I just write drunk and edit sober. Literally, like, I will just sit at my laptop and just type out just random things. Like, scene one, I'm sitting in a chair and there is a projection and the projection has people kissing and I am doing a dance move, insert dance move here. And once I kind of write out the drunk part, then I take a break. And then the next day I try to decipher my scribbles into a script, basically.
So I guess I need to ask, are you literally drunk with a glass of wine writing this?
Yes, because it actually does. I mean, look, don't drink and write or do drugs and write. I'm not condoning this at all. It does help a little bit, though, especially because I am of age. And it does help. I've noticed that, like, a little bit of intoxication does lift the veil, especially for me because I am a very, like, my ADHD brain is like, okay, we have to focus on this thing and hyper-focus on this thing, and we can't do anything else except this focus on this thing. And writing artistic pieces and doing that is tricky, mm-hmm. because it's my brain is just telling me, okay, focus, 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 but I'm not getting any ideas. Whereas, you know, having a little glass of wine or something like that lifts that, those blinders, so I can create a little bit more and have my brain expand on, like, how... why I'm talking about, you know, the femme and the masculine sides of people while I'm doing a burlesque, you know, movement to this. Mm-hmm. So all of that literally came from Write Drunk, Get It Sober. And for those that don't know, there is a piece in my show where I do talk about the anima and animus, which are archetypes from Carl Jung's archetypes of the self. And the anima and animus, everybody has them. So it is the feminine and the masculine sides that everybody have, and I talk about these two sides intertwining into the kind of passion of online dating, specifically when you get to the point where it's like, ooh, okay, I've gone on the date, okay, they're really, really hot, all right, I really want to take them home, all right, I think I'm gonna have sex with them. Like, mm-hmm. So yeah, that's, it does help.
And so I guess maybe we can move more into the show itself and kind of the structure of it and everything. And you've already talked a little bit about the opening with the trying on the different outfits that are kind of like different versions of me I can sell mm-hmm. to, you know, to this date. And you know, I think that's a little bit more profound than just, I'm trying on a different outfit. It's sort of like, as you talked about earlier, the way you present yourself online, mm-hmm. right? That you can present yourself in many different ways and see which one maybe sells better to this particular person than right. another. But there's a whole lot of use of mixed media in this, right? Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of times when people are going to a play or a stage performance, mm-hmm. they assume that's going to be very much an actor alone up on stage or a couple actors. But in this instance, you're using a lot of video, you're using a lot of voiceover and projection, different things like that. What helped you get to the point where you were thinking, okay, I want to use more of this kind of mixed media in here instead of it just being me, Zoe, up on stage?
I became inspired to incorporate more technology into my piece after I took Craig Gingrich Philbrook's media and performance course last semester. And in that course, there was a lot of discussion about how digital performance can be used in live performance. And I remember doing a very, very, very rough kind of scene that actually got incorporated into Left on Red, but I wanted to experiment and try out, you know, how does this work with other people? And I wanted to get CGP's kind of talk back with that so I can tweak things. So from there, everything just kind of blossomed and opened up. I've really, since that class, I've really been inspired and just flabbergasted with how digital performance and using technology and using kind of, and me kind of performing to myself or having a projected version of myself kind of perform with me as a new mode of a solo show where, like, you know, yes, it is me physically, but it's also me on the screen, but you're also hearing me too. And it is still me and my voice and my presence, but it's just me in different modes. And that really pushed the technological, subject and themes of Left on Red. Originally, I wanted Left on Red to be more like Ex Machina and more like kind of Ghost in the Shell, like where there's more of this technical kind of dystopian postmodern feel to it. But again, kind of like I said before, I wanted to do all these things, but I had to stay focused on what the show is. So I don't know, that gives me more opportunity to work on more performances to incorporate that. But having technological, different modes of technology in a solo show, where it also kind of helped work out the kinks of how online presence is shown in front of others. So going back to the beginning of the show where it's me as a CEO typing on screen, talking about Left on Red as the newest dating app to hit app stores nationwide. Mm-hmm. Having that, and I remember recording that at my house, and I did that as more of an experiment to go like, all right, well, I wonder what would happen if like me, but not me, was on stage kind of introducing everything to the audience instead of in the traditional mode of performance where there's usually the narrator or the narratee kind of talking about what's going to happen in the show and the why the show is necessary. So having those elements or those parts to it kind of, just made it made the show come to life the more I fucked with technology in the piece.
Yeah, I think one of the more interesting moments in the show is when you are engaging and responding to yourself up on the projection, and you know you're having this back and forth. And just from a technical standpoint, as I'm watching the show, I'm going, okay, that's done very well, the timing on here. So how did you work that out?
The timing was really hard to get down, especially the hardest part that I had with the timing. It wasn't the beginning scene when I like walk, when my digital self sees me walk across the stage. That was actually really easy. The one that was really hard was in the third part of the show where I'm responding to these texts that are coming behind me by like touching myself. Right. And that kind of snippet came from a longer snippet that came from a longer snippet that I had to condense down, because if I were to do the original, that original message scene, it would be like a 15 to 20 minute piece, which was really exhausting, especially because at that point I'm just like on stage, no water, go, 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 go. And I don't get a water break until like halfway through the show. So I have to pace myself, but aligning myself both like physically on stage and movement wise with the response of the text messages between me and the partner that I'm texting, and also trying to look sexy possessed for lack of a better term on stage is a lot harder than it looks when you don't see what you're kind of wiggling and wriggling to. And like, there were so many days of rehearsal where I'm like, all right, I have to just sit in front of the screen and time it out. And that's how I really honestly got the, honestly, my years of band really helped me in this case where I'm like, all right, one and two and three and four and message, two and three and four and one and two and response and two and three and four. So
I'm really glad you explained that, because initially my many years of band helped me with this.
And it helps. Yes. Yeah.
No, that makes sense.
And so having that honestly, like really, really did help, because having that timing in the back of my head, I knew, okay, around this time, it's starting to get to the point and move. And then I would do my thing.
So that scene, since you brought it up and everything, that scene is, I think, you know, obviously one of the big moments of the production. But it's also a very personal moment.
Yeah.
It's a very sort of vulnerable moment, I think, for you up on stage. And I'm always very impressed by actors who are willing to do something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can maybe explain this a little bit more in depth and everything, but you're essentially having a sexting conversation with a partner, and we are seeing the text on the screen behind you, but you are facing out towards the audience and simulating acts, not actually doing anything on stage. Let's clarify that.
Yes. I think SIU would have issues if I actually like dropped trow and like masturbated on stage.
Well, I mean, you know, you might be surprised, but who knows? But like, how do you prepare as a performer for something like that?
That's a really good question. I know most performers or actors that do more of a method acting sense have their own kind of, I think of a color, or I think of an experience that I've had. Or there was one show that I did with Andrea where she told me, like, think of a person that you really want to, like, have sex with, and just imagine you, like, doing these acts with them, and then take that emotion and then work with it. For me to get prepared for doing things like this, a lot of it was in part of me doing body painting in the nude for the past couple of years while I was living in Houston. So I'm used to and very comfortable being, like, you know, topless and having people kind of gawk and go ooh and ah and like all of those things. And that got me used to the fact that my body is a body. It is a female body, and that most females have similar anatomy to that. And just that, having that experience gave me I don't mean to like say this in a rude way, but it normalized this fear of, oh my God, my boobs are going to be in front of everybody, or oh my God, like they're going to make fun of me or laugh at me or say mean things, because I've heard it all before and it don't care. Like, but that really helped me prepare for scenes like that. Also, in my first show, Obscene Phenomena, before it was an online adaptation, or even then, there's a part where I'm fully topless and I'm just like backlit, so I look like one of those aliens from Mars Attacks, like, you know, the big dramatic lighting in the background. I had that, and I was topless, and I did a very powerful kind of, you know, feminism, yay, rant about women. So I'm just used to that. Yeah.
How did you get into body painting?
Here's a fun story. Yeah. So in high school, one of my first jobs was I was a scare actor at a haunted house called Phobia in Houston. And I was a scare actor.
Very cool.
Yeah. It came with perks. I mean, it was a nice seasonal job, but it did definitely have like issues. Like one that I'm still having now is on Halloween one year, I got punched in the jaw. And now I still have like jaw issues, but
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thank you, but it's cool. But I really got into prosthetics and horror makeup, and I got really good at it. And there's a place in Houston called Techland that sells everything from prosthetics to lighting to sound equipment for stages, whatever you can think of theater-wise, performance-wise, they have. And I was talking to the owner and just kind of picking his brain because I wanted to get an internship. And he told me about this guy named Rudy Campos, who is now my bestie. We've been best friends for about 4 or 5 years. And I remember like messaging him on Facebook, being very polite and, you know, academic wise, like, good afternoon, Mr. Campos. My name is Zoe Friedkin, and I would love to be, you know, love to intern with you. And I got, his response back was, are you free around 7 p.m. tonight? Because a model of mine dipped out, so he needed a model. And he was like, come over. His girlfriend was there too, so it wasn't just us alone. But he was like, come over, I'll paint you, we'll talk about this and see if this is really something you want to do. And it just became history after that. After that meeting, I remember doing multiple shoots and just doing like public appearances and things like that. Like most recently, there's Rudy and I and my partner Walter got paint. Well, he painted me, Rudy painted me, and we went out into like downtown Houston just to promote his body painting and things. So that's kind of how it all started. And it's been a fun experience. Having that experience is a really great tool in the toolbox for me when it comes to presenting myself, how to present myself, how to represent others in a very tasteful way, even though I'm like fully, everybody can see my boobs. But it taught me a lot about networking, is as weird as it sounds, like talking to other artists or other body painters and working with them and collaborating with them and kind of getting that experience. Also, too, in a sense, doing a, quote, PR report of, like, you know, tastefully promoting Rudy and his work and kind of the body painting stuff that I've done in an academic or in, which honestly, just real quick, I got really nervous applying here because I did a lot of the body painting things, again, were in the nude. And I thought, oh, my God, SIU isn't going to accept me because they're going to see this. And they were like, nah, it's fine. So it was a good save.
I was going to say, then you met the faculty here and you were exactly. Like, these people do not care at all.
Yeah, I know. I think this is the least, this is like the most tame they've seen.
So back to the show, mm-hmm. You know, it's collectively this, the show about dating and online, but then it kind of goes beyond that into like kind of coming to terms with yourself in the process of dating and everything, and maybe being kind to yourself in this process of dating. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you want people to come away from the production with? What are you hoping the impact of this might be on the audience?
I really have to think about this because this is going to sound weird, but I'll explain it.
Okay.
I want audience members to feel uncomfortable. I want them to go, why does this make me, why am I uncomfortable? Mm-hmm. And I say that because as a method of performance, of course, you know, making somebody happy or sad or for an actor, it's very hard to make somebody like laugh and cry or to even an actor to simulate that and to make it seem real. But the sense of uncomfortableness, it's potent in the sense that it makes you think a lot longer on why it makes you feel uncomfortable. Why am I feeling these things and kind of confronting that. And that's really what a goal that I have for my audiences. I want y'all to kind of think about, you know, why do these parts of the show make me feel uncomfortable, or why do they make me feel angry or sad, or, you know, like I'm about to cry. So I want that introspection and that kind of couple days afterwards come up to me and go, I'm still thinking about the show. Like this really like affected me in some way. And the other thing I want my audience to come out of is just to feel like they're not alone. One of the big comments that I've gotten from the show is how relatable it is, especially for both actually masculine, non-binary and femme individuals. It makes me very happy to know, like, you know, my experiences are, you know, other people do have similar ones to that, and they can take the content that I am presenting and showing them and make it relatable to them. And that's what makes me really, really happy is like, cool, like I spoke to you. My goal is I want my work to speak to you in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And if I can do that, then I feel good. I feel like I've done my job. Even if you don't feel like anything, that's still doing my job, because sometimes it takes a couple days or a couple weeks or a month to register the things, because there's a lot of like heavy, heavy content. You know, I'm talking about, I'm literally confessing about the worst first kiss ever. I'm talking to the audience in a confessional session of why I don't want to date mods, quote unquote mods anymore, people online. I do a full burlesque routine where I'm showing my body and literally like, even like with the words, one of the sections that got talked about a lot, especially even at a the Pettijean Performance Festival was the I want to fuck you like how Texas fucked abortion law. I want to pound you down like Chris Brown. Those lines really got people's attention in many, many ways. A lot of it was, that's unnecessary. Like, why did you have to say it like that? A lot of it also was like, wow, we've come to a point in life and society that like we have to say it like this to get some kind of meaning, which is a very interesting kind of thought in itself, you know, having to phrase ideas in a very vulgar way to kind of get somebody to go, oh shit. But also even the most kind of question I've got was like, why did you reference the Chris Brown thing, you know, or why did you specifically reference, you know, the Texas abortion law stuff, which to that I say, I do it because I want to explain and also show that dating is not, you know, puppies, not all dating situations are puppies and rainbows and everybody finds their true love. There is very serious consequences to, I mean, just even in general, promoting yourself on social media, promoting yourself on a dating app, and that there are still people who are very vigilant on trying to, like, I don't know, they're vigilant on, or I guess preying more so on people that just don't know or that think that the internet is okay or is quote unquote safe. Even like with Bumble, where like with Bumble's thing, it's women make the first move. But even in that, I've kind of experienced like just hate, ugliness, and things along those lines don't just stop just because, you know, you can just delete a message.
Do you think people are going into dating a little bit naive? I mean, I asked this because, you know, those two lines that you mentioned, right? Those mm-hmm. are sort of kind of scare lines for women about abortion particularly, right? And whether they have rights to their body autonomy. And the Chris Brown is kind of the maybe other end of the spectrum, also a scare line to some mm-hmm. degree.
I think that the word ignorant may not be the best word. Just because, like, I feel like having a sense of, like, ignorance is more in, like, a negative of, like, you know, these people just don't know. And I feel like they do know. It's that sometimes the personality that is presented online can feel one way, but then once you meet them, it can be a totally different thing, if that answers the question. It's more so a sense of, I don't think it's ignorance. I don't think it's denial that like, oh, nothing can happen to me on the internet because I'm safe or because I'm behind a screen. It's a lot deeper than that. It's a lot more, it's not like how like on the street, like someone can, you know, come up to a person and just do whatever. Whereas online, it's a lot more methodical. It's more like, you know, hey, I'm posing and seeming like a very nice person, and I'm posing and seeming like I'm really interested in this and the things that you like. And yes, we're talking, but it's just the personality can be a big distraction, I guess.
So you did mention that you had put this on at a festival. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us the name of that again?
Yeah, the festival is the Pettijean Performance Festival at Pettijean State Park in Arkansas. It's one of the longest running performance festivals. I believe it's one of the longest running performance festivals that still is occurring. I think it started in like the 70s or 80s and then is still happening now, of course, with COVID. But the universe, it's a performance festival where a bunch of universities, like this year, University of North Texas, Capital University, University of Houston, Clear Lake, SIU, and Prairie View A&M came, and it was a cool kind of, it's not really like a traditional conference where like there's like panels and things like that. It's more so getting everybody kind of coming into this collective space. There was a festival leader who this year I'm drawing a blank on her name, but she's in a button poetry, or she does button, does slam poetry. And we talk about the theme of the festival. The undergrads get clumped up into groups with a graduate student, and their mission is to create a performance in the spirit of the theme of the festival. And it's just a weekend of experimenting with performance, talking to professors, networking, making friends, playing cards. Like, it's fun. It's a lovely and very fulfilling experience for people who enjoy performance.
So what's next for this show? Are you going to do something else with this particular show, or moving on to the next show? What do you think?
So as of now, the game plan is, besides working on or chipping away at the first chapter of my thesis, by the end of December, my goal is to have an artist portfolio curated. So I have all the shows that I've been a part of, photos, the what it's about, and kind of my experience with it. And what I plan to do is, with that, starting in December, January, apply for fringe festivals, fringe performance festivals in the U.S. and other kind of performance-y festivals that occur in Chicago, St. Louis, the Midwest, Houston. And then I plan to take my show to take Left on Red and do performances there. And that's the start. That's just the beginning. And then see just where it goes.
And can you explain to the audience what a fringe festival is?
So a fringe festival is a type of performance festival that, I want to actually look this up and actually give the name or the verbatim of like what it is, instead of me, you know, thinking like, oh, it's this, it's that. I would rather give you all the facts and not just me rambling and saying, I think it's this or I think it's that. Where is, hold on. Ugh. I hate SIU's Wi-Fi. SIU's Wi-Fi is just insane.
But I certainly understand wanting to give a very concrete definition and not like your personal definition that might not fully encompass somebody might call you on. That doesn't encompass everything.
Fringes are focused on the performing arts. They are uncensored performances, easy to participate in. They're also original pieces that use kind of have this rapid fire tech element to it. Typically the tech is minimal and time is a factor in the festival. Shows are often brief, so at the most 60 minutes. So they are pretty short. Mm. But at its core, Fringe Fest gives a spotlight to theater, dance, puppetry, music, visual arts, and spoken word. Fringes do not have a focus on one single discipline or genre, but are more of a performing arts smorgasbord, basically. And so you submit your performances of what you want to do, depending on the type of Fringe Fest. Like, for example, Minnesota Fringe Fest, there are once you've submitted, then you get put basically into a lottery. And then from the lottery, there are tiers that you kind of choose. So, and the different tiers associate with how big the spaces are going to be that you're going to perform in. So, like, tier one would be a space between like 50 and 100 people. And once you've got once you have a spot in one of those tiers, then it's your job to promote, do all the promoting, put up posters, get people to kind of come to the show. And to you are as a fringe performer, you are the PR person, you're the director, you're the performer, you're the tech person. Well, at least in my case, because I'll be doing it solo. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad I'm in your class so I can learn a lot more about how to promote.
Well, and that's going to be very challenging. Your show, it does have a second actor at one point, at least. And so that will be fairly challenging, I imagine, trying to put it on all by yourself.
I mean, at one point in the show, like, because there's the second actor part. Originally, I wanted to do a plant, which in performance-y, theater-y terms, it's just basically like a person who is chosen to perform, but look like, that they're just like your average Joe. I wanted to use a plant in the show or to basically like kind of pick someone to play with. However, thinking about it a lot more definitely was not the plan, because there can be issues of like, I pick somebody and they don't want to perform with you.
Sure.
So because I'm putting it out there, when I get selected, I will figure that portion out when it gets closer.
Okay. So we're just about out of time. I did want to ask you one final question here. What advice would you give to the listening audience about dating?
I would say be careful, because sometimes we get addicted to the personality instead of the person. Don't get emotionally catfished. If you feel like it's sus, then maybe trust your gut. But at the same time, too, I mean, dating apps are a fantastic platform to just, even at its most basic form, to just interact and engage with other people that may not be in the area that you're from, which is exciting in a sense. You know, you're talking to a total stranger in a safe, quote unquote, safe environment. And just be you, be authentically you, you know. People will, I don't want to be like the typical, like, you'll find somebody, there's fish in the sea. No, because not everybody thinks that way, but just be you. Just be you, and and also background check sometimes, because you never know. You never know with people.
That sounds like very good, with a little bit of practical advice.
Yes.
Included in there. Very good advice. All right.
Thank you so much, Justin, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you, Zoe. Thank you for doing this. This has been my pleasure to interview you for this and talk about your show. I did want to tell you, by the way, obviously I did go see the show. I know it enough to talk about it. I very much enjoyed it. It's very good.
Thank you.
And, you know, so if you are near a Fringe Festival where Zoe's performing, I would recommend, it's very much worth your time to go check out Left on Red. Thank you again, Zoe, for being the guest this week. Thank you for everyone listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode.